Hello, I'm Joseph Kassa, and welcome to this podcast where the AI team does a deep dive into some application of systems thinking.
You know, usually when a fire alarm goes off in a building, there is this this expectation of immediate, really straightforward action.
Right. You just react.
Exactly. You grab the nearest fire extinguisher,
yeah.
You aim it at the base of the flames, and you put the fire out. It's very linear. I mean, it's problem solution. Done.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what if the fire started because the entire electrical grid of the building was wired poorly 30 years ago? And the insulation has just been slowly degrading ever since.
Yeah, suddenly that single fire extinguisher feels pretty inadequate.
Totally.
And it feels inadequate because, you know, you're treating a symptom while completely ignoring the disease. I mean, the fire is just the spectacular end result of decades of invisible structural decay.
And today, that is exactly what we're exploring. In this deep dive, our mission is to really unpack a brilliant manual for seeing that hidden wiring. We're looking at Wallace Wright's book, Learn Systems Thinking.
It's such a necessary read.
It really is. Wright's entire premise is about how you can transition away from constantly fighting those daily fires, what he calls linear mechanistic thinking, and start understanding the hidden mechanics that actually drive our world, our businesses, and, you know, our personal lives.
Yeah, it shifts your whole perspective.
Right. So to help us connect all these dots, we have our resident expert here with us to dive into the source material. So where do we even begin to rewrite the matrix of our lives?
Well, we have to start by completely rewriting our default setting for problem solving. I mean, we have been trained our entire lives to rely on analysis.
It's breaking things down.
Exactly. If you think about the word analysis, it literally means to dissect. It's taking a highly complex problem and just breaking it down into its individual, isolated component parts to understand it.
Right.
But Wright argues that to solve modern, complex problems, analysis is actually a trap.
Wow, a trap.
Yeah. What we desperately need instead is synthesis. And synthesis is all about interconnectedness. It's looking at how the parts interact dynamically to create a whole that is entirely new.
He uses this fantastic kitchen analogy in the book to explain this.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
He points out that a kitchen on its own is just a collection of loose parts. You know, you have a refrigerator, some granite counters, a sink, a pantry.
Just stuff in a room.
Right. They happen to share the same physical space, but without a singular interconnected purpose, they're literally just a collection of stuff. But an oven is a true system.
Because the specific components of the oven, the heating coils, the electrical wiring, the internal thermostat, the insulated door, they're all interacting very precisely to achieve a greater purpose.
Cooking food.
Exactly. You cannot just isolate the heating coil, plug it into the wall, and expect it to bake a cake perfectly.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
No, the ability to bake emerges strictly from the interconnectedness of those parts working together.
Okay, let's unpack this. If I'm trying to visualize synthesis versus analysis in my own life, analysis feels like taking a car engine completely apart, like laying every single spark plug, piston, and timing belt out on the garage floor in a neat little row just to see how the engine works.
That's a great way to put it.
But synthesis is standing on an overpass, watching that same car merge onto a crowded highway during rush hour to understand why it behaved the way it does in traffic.
Yes, exactly.
In synthesis, you are looking at the relationships, the momentum, and the environment, not just the isolated parts.
What's fascinating here is that to achieve that synthesis, the book demands we stop looking at simple flat lines of cause and effect. You know, A causes B.
Right, the linear thinking.
Yeah, we have to start looking at three-dimensional recurring loops. And to help us visualize this shift, Wright introduces the iceberg model.
Oh, this model really caught my attention because it explains so much about human nature. Yeah. Like, we are incredibly reactive creatures.
Oh, absolutely.
When we look out at the water, we only see the tip of the iceberg poking out above the surface. And in Wright's model, that visible tip represents events.
Right. And events are just the daily occurrences that grab our immediate attention.
The fires.
Exactly. Yeah. A massive product recall at your company, a sudden drop in quarterly sales, or to use Wright's very relatable personal example from the book, a child catching a nasty cold.
Yeah. That happens all the time.
And we are evolutionarily wired to react to the immediate threat. So we react to the event, we give the child cold medicine, we put out the fire.
But the vast majority of the iceberg is hidden deep underwater. Like right below the surface, supporting the event, you have patterns.
Mm-hmm.
These are the recurring trends over time. So the pattern isn't just one isolated cold, right?
Right.
The pattern is noticing that the child gets sick every single month, usually right after forgetting to wash their hands when coming inside from playing in the dirt.
And if you hold your breath and dive all the way down to the dark, deep base of that iceberg, you finally locate the systemic structures.
The root of it all.
Yes. This is the foundational architecture that generates the patterns, which in turn cause the events.
So in the case of the sick child,
the systemic structure isn't a virus at all. It might be the total lack of a daily hygiene routine in the household. Or maybe the fact that the bathroom sink is simply too high for the child to reach comfortably on their own.
Oh, wow. So if you just treat the event, you are perpetually running to the pharmacy to buy cold medicine.
And you're exhausted.
Right. But if you address the systemic structure, like you just buy a step stool and build a non-negotiable hand-washing routine before dinner, you change the pattern.
And the events stop happening entirely.
It's brilliant. But getting past the tip of the iceberg requires recognizing the traps we constantly fall into, right? Wright calls these underwater traps system archetypes.
Yeah, archetypes are essentially the recurring narrative loops that cause systems to repeatedly fail.
Okay.
Recognizing them is basically like having a map of a minefield before you walk into it. And the first major archetype he discusses is called fixing the fixes that fail.
Oh, this is the classic scenario where we constantly treat symptoms instead of systemic issues. Wright brings up the old squeaky wheel analogy.
Right.
You have a squeaky wheel on a cart, so you grab some grease and lubricate it. The squeak immediately stops. You feel incredibly productive.
You solve the problem, or so you think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what if the wheel is squeaking because it's fundamentally misaligned and actually needs an entirely new axle?
Yeah, the grease is just the surface fix that ultimately fails.
And because you ignored the structure, the wheel eventually snaps off completely while you are moving a heavy load.
The book also uses a medical example that illustrates the exact mechanism of this archetype.
Oh, right. The hypertension one.
Yes. Imagine a patient who presents to their doctor with severe hypertension. The immediate surface fix, you know, the grease on the wheel, is prescribing blood pressure medication.
Which makes sense on a surface level.
Right. It does. But if the doctor doesn't look at the systemic structure, they miss the real issue. Let's say the patient is living in a highly toxic, abusive environment or working an impossibly demanding job that is generating chronic, unmanageable stress.
The medication is just artificially masking a symptom.
Exactly. The underlying system is still actively destroying the patient's health.
I see this constantly in technology, too. It's like constantly buying new charging cables every month because you think they keep breaking or wearing out.
Oh, yeah.
When the actual problem is a broken, dirt-filled charging port on your phone that is damaging every single cable you plug into it,
right?
You are fixing the fix, but the system is fundamentally broken, which leads right into another terrifying archetype from the book, Drifting Goals.
Yeah.
Right? Uses the classic boiling frog analogy to explain the mechanism here.
Yeah, so if you drop a frog in boiling water, it instantly registers the extreme threat and jumps out. But if you put it in tepid water and incrementally turn up the heat, the frog gets apathetic, relaxes, and eventually boils to death because the sensory change is just so gradual.
It's scary how that happens.
It is. And the mechanism at play here is our tolerance for slowly degrading standards. In business, this happens when we constantly lower our goals to avoid short-term pain.
Like what?
Well, for example, a manufacturing plant keeps extending its production deadlines week after week instead of undergoing the massive, painful process of completely overhauling the broken workflow on the factory floor.
Okay, but wait, let me push back on this a bit.
Sure.
Because in the real world, rigid goals can ruin a company.
Mm-hmm.
How can you, as a manager, or even just in your personal life, tell the difference between a legitimate strategic adjustment of a goal based on new data, like maybe the market shifted or a global supply chain broke, versus just being the apathetic boiling frog sliding into mediocrity?
That is a crucial distinction to make. And Wright provides a very specific framework to test this. You have to honestly examine the gap between your ideal goal and your actual reality. Are you taking difficult, tangible, corrective action to close that gap?
Mm-hmm.
Are you changing your strategy to meet the high standard? Or are you just permanently lowering the standard to relieve internal pressure and avoid having a tough conversation with your team?
Well, I see.
Yeah. If the goal drops simply to meet the poor performance, you are the frog.
I want to pause here because I am genuinely a bit confused by the terminology. We keep talking about these archetypes, but earlier we mentioned loops. How is a system archetype actually different from a feedback loop? Because they sound like the same thing.
It's a really great question. Think of it this way. The archetype is the overall pattern of behavior. It's the trap itself, like the boiling frog or the squeaky wheel.
Okay.
The feedback loop is the actual mechanical engine inside the system that drives that behavior.
The engine. Got it.
Right. Feedback loops are the flow of information and consequences that dictate how a system moves. And there are two fundamental types. The first is a reinforcing loop.
Which amplifies things, right?
Yes. It's an engine of pure amplification. It takes whatever direction the system is going and accelerates it. It can amplify massive growth, like compounding interest in a retirement account.
Which is great.
But it can also amplify destruction, like a tiny trickle of water slowly eroding a crack in a massive concrete dam.
Oh, man.
The more water flows, the wider the crack gets, which lets more water flow until the entire dam just bursts.
And the other type is a balancing loop, right?
Exactly.
These are the self-correcting mechanisms that aim for stability rather than exponential growth or collapse.
Yeah.
It's like the thermostat in your house.
A perfect example.
If the temperature drops below 70 degrees, the heat kicks on. Once it hits 70, the heat turns off. It balances. Or how predator and prey populations keep each other in check in a forest ecosystem.
Exactly right. Balancing loops are the stabilizing forces of the world. But here is the catch that Wright really emphasizes. Balancing loops rarely operate perfectly in real time.
There's a lag.
Yes. There is almost always a lag between the action and the feedback. And that introduces the critical concept of delays.
Delays.
Right? Breaks these down into physical, transactional, informational, and perceptual delays.
So what does this all mean? The book uses this fictional company, Tosco, to illustrate how these delays actually play out. And it's a fascinating case study in how things go wrong.
It really is.
So imagine this toaster company, Tosco. They launch a brilliant, revolutionary new convection toaster. The marketing is perfect, and it is a massive hit.
Everyone wants one.
Right. But they didn't strategically plan for their production limits. They have physical delays. Like, it literally takes a year to build a new factory.
Mm-hmm.
And informational delays, meaning the sales data takes weeks to reach the executives.
Right. So to meet this sudden, booming demand with limited capacity, the executives just panic.
Which we all do.
Yeah. They speed up the existing assembly line and force massive overtime. But because the workers are exhausted and rushing, the physical reality is that quality drops. Defective toasters start hitting the market. Now, a perceptual delay kicks in. Customers start realizing the toasters are garbage and their trust evaporates. Demand crashes.
But remember that physical delay?
Yes.
Tosco just spent tens of millions of dollars building new, massive factories to meet the initial demand.
Yep.
Those shiny new facilities finally open their doors right when absolutely nobody wants a Tosco toaster anymore.
Yeah.
The system just collapses.
And when you look at that Tosco example, it's the perceptual delays that really drive the panic.
Oh, totally. The sheer human anxiety of waiting for a product to hit the market or, you know, waiting for a result from a new diet. That anxiety makes us panic. We overreact simply because the feedback isn't instantaneous.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, overreacting to these natural built-in delays is exactly what throws a healthy balancing loop into total chaos.
Right.
The psychological mechanism is really interesting. When we don't get immediate feedback, our brain assumes the input didn't register at all.
Like pushing the elevator button 5 times.
Exactly. Or Wright's analogy, it's like steering a large boat. You turn the heavy wooden wheel to the right to avoid a rock. The boat doesn't turn immediately because of the physical delay of the water resistance.
So you panic.
You panic and yank the wheel as hard as you can to the right. By the time the boat actually responds, you have massively overcompensated and you crash into the dock on the other side.
Wow.
You have to respect the delay built into the system.
But even if Toscore perfectly calculated their factory delays, and even if you know exactly how long a boat takes to turn, you are still assuming that the people inside the system act completely rationally.
Which they don't.
Right. And the moment you introduce human ego and panic into a loop, the math goes out the window. These structural loops don't exist in a vacuum. They are warped by our own self-interest and our deeply held biases.
Absolutely. And Wright insists that any system review is fundamentally incomplete without examining what he calls our mental models. He outlines an archetype called success to the successful, which demonstrates how unconscious bias structurally rewards those who already have a head start while actively holding others back. It is a really powerful reinforcing loop.
The example Wright analyzes from the source material is the gender pay gap in corporate environments.
Right.
He points out a specific flawed mental model, the underlying, often unconscious perception by leadership that women are somehow less committed to their long-term careers because of the potential for future maternity leaves or family obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Because of this initial bias, leadership assigns fewer high-profile, high-risk projects to women.
And we have to look at the mechanism of what happens next. Because women in this system are given fewer critical opportunities to visibly prove their value and generate revenue, they naturally advance less quickly through the ranks.
Right.
When executives look at the data years later, they see more men succeeding and falsely conclude that their initial bias was correct.
Which is just wild.
It creates a systemic, self-fulfilling prophecy. The underlying structure of the system was unconsciously designed to reward the group it already deemed successful, actively starving the other group of the resources needed to compete.
It's a devastating loop. And then Wright introduces another human-driven trap, the tragedy of the commons.
Oh, this one is huge.
This is all about how rational self-interest completely ruins the collective good. Wright uses Los Angeles traffic as the prime example.
A nightmare.
Truly. Everyone individually decides that the convenience of driving their own car alone is paramount. It is the rational choice for the individual.
Sure.
But the collective result of millions of people making that individual choice is the total destruction of the public infrastructure.
Mm.
Absolute gridlock. Nobody gets anywhere.
We see this happen inside large organizations all the time, manifesting as corporate fiefdoms.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's say one division of a tech company hoards its budget, its top engineers, and its data to make their specific team look incredible to the board.
Right. They want to be the stars.
Exactly. They are optimizing their individual slice of the pie. But in doing so, they starve the rest of the company of vital collaboration, ultimately killing the centralized vision and causing the entire company's stock to plummet.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because the tragedy of the commons feels like an impossible catch-22 for you and me.
How so?
Well, let's say you realize you were in this system and you decide to act for the collective good. You voluntarily give up your department's budget to help another team, or you start taking the bus in LA.
Okay.
But if your coworkers or neighbors continue to act selfishly and hoard resources, you just end up losing. You get trampled by the people exploiting the commons. How does Wright suggest we actually overcome this human nature?
He acknowledges how incredibly difficult it is, but the solution he pulls from the framework is that you cannot just appeal to people's morality.
Morality isn't enough.
No, morality doesn't reliably change systemic behavior. You have to fundamentally redefine the incentives through a process called systems mapping.
Systems mapping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to sit down and visually map the entire system to explicitly show the selfish stakeholders that their individual slice of the pie will inevitably rot if the whole bakery burns down.
Oh, I love that.
You have to tangibly align the short-term individual incentive with the long-term collective health.
And this realization leads us to the ultimate actionable takeaway of the book. If we are stuck in these loops, how do we actually step outside of this massive machine and redesign it?
Right.
Wright introduces a crucial distinction between what he calls technical solutions and adaptive strategies.
So technical solutions are the quick fixes. They rely entirely on top-down authority and simple cause and effect assumptions.
Take a Band-Aid.
Exactly. But adaptive strategies are a completely different paradigm. They are highly flexible, they are inherently cross-disciplinary, and they require us to actually change our underlying beliefs and values, not just our rules.
The book uses the crisis of childhood obesity and school lunches to paint a vivid picture of this.
It's a great example.
If a school administrator uses a technical fix, they just ban soda on campus. Boom. Done.
Yes.
Problem solved, right?
In theory.
But what happens when that student walks out the cafeteria door at 3 p.m. into a neighborhood flooded with billions of dollars in fast food marketing and then goes home to a family that works three jobs and only has the time and budget to buy subsidized, heavily processed food?
The technical fix does nothing for that.
Exactly. An adaptive strategy recognizes this massive interconnected web. It looks at corporate agricultural subsidies, the drastic differences between rural and urban school funding, and family accountability at home.
A technical fix imperialistically imposes a rule from the top down.
Right.
An adaptive strategy requires deep facilitation. You cannot just command the system to change. You have to bring all those marginalized local stakeholders to the table to design the solution together. Wright shares a really profound historical anecdote to make this point.
Oh, the missionary story.
Exactly. British missionaries arrive in a rural African village during the colonial era, and they look at the locals and decide they need what they consider proper clothing.
According to their own standards.
Right. So the missionaries imperially impose a technical fix based on their own narrow worldview. They hand out thick, heavy woolen suits.
Which sounds awful.
It was. Because they do this right as the monsoon season hits. The woolen suits become completely soaked, oppressive, unable to dry, and actually cause the locals to become severely ill with respiratory infections.
It is the ultimate tragic example of why top-down imposition fails. If you do not consult the local stakeholders who actually understand the environment and the hidden loops, your well-intentioned fix becomes a systemic disaster.
Absolutely.
There is a mantra in this book that I want you to write down and remember, and it is this: work on the system, not in the system.
This raises an important question. How exactly do we view the system from the outside to work on it? Wright answers this with his final, most practical tool systems mapping. And he makes a really profound distinction here between looking at a political map versus a geographical map.
When I read this, it completely shifted how I view my own workplace.
Yeah, a political map shows rigid human-made boundaries. It shows state lines, county borders, national demarcations.
The artificial stuff.
Exactly. It's how we artificially divine the world based on human rules. But a geographical map shows the natural, physical, interconnected reality. It shows where the mountain ranges actually flow, how the coastlines connect across borders, and where the watershed naturally runs.
So if we only look at the political map of our company or our lives, the official HR org chart, the strict job titles, the departmental silos, we completely miss the reality of how the work actually gets done.
Exactly.
We have to draw the geographical reality of our problems. We have to map out where the informal power actually flows, who talks to whom by the coffee machine, where the real bottlenecks are.
That is the essence of systems mapping. It forces us to take out a whiteboard and draw the actual relationships, the feedback loops, the hidden delays.
Right.
It physically takes us out of linear, event-level thinking and puts the entire messy, interconnected web on the table where everyone can finally see it.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive into Wallace Wright's Learned Systems Thinking, it is clear that this isn't just a dry business book about corporate efficiency.
Not at all.
It is a survival manual for moving from being a passive reactor, exhausted from just putting out daily fires, to being an active, intentional designer of your own environment.
By looking beneath the tip of the iceberg to find the systemic structures, by respecting the natural delays in the world instead of panicking, and by shifting your mind from dissecting parts to synthesizing the whole, you gain an incredible advantage.
Yeah, you really do.
It is the ultimate shortcut to being a highly effective thinker in a complex world.
It changes everything. You finally realize that the fire in the kitchen wasn't a random accident or a stroke of bad luck. It was an inevitable symptom of the wiring you ignored.
Perfectly said.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to ponder today. We have talked a lot about systems we build or inherit, but consider the invisible systems you interact with every single day. Like the AI algorithms curating your social media feeds or your news consumption.
Oh, that's a big one.
Right. There's a massive automated reinforcing feedback loop. It learns what outrages you or engages you, and it feeds you more of it, incrementally shifting your
I
worldview
hope you
without you ever
enjoyed
noticing.
today's
The
deep
ultimate
dive.
boiling frog.
Why not
Exactly.
take a
Okay.
moment
As you
to
start
join the
mapping out the hidden
discussion
structures in your
in
life,
the
ask yourself,
LinkedIn
are you the
group
one actively
tackling
programming your
complex
loops, or has an
problems?
algorithm already
Take
mapped you?
care.